it can be restrictive, but you know, in the first part of your question, you're right. We do have sufficient deal flow that I wouldn't call it a limiting factor. You know, it does act, you know, that focus does have us sometimes passing on deals that could be very compelling, but for it just doesn't really match our particular mandate.
I think it's great that you guys have got such a tight mandate, tight criteria, clear on what you're looking for, and no doubt that actually increases your deal flow, whereas most people think that would threaten it. Where do you think that challenge comes from? Do you think it sits at the PE VC level not offering something like a vessel that will solve that remaining two-third challenge? Do we think that there isn't as much of a call from an LP perspective because, you know, it's perceived as sexy to invest in electronic vehicles and Tesla ripping up the world maps? Where do you see the actual catalyst of the problem actually coming from? Welcome back to the Raw Selection Private Equity Podcast. Joining us today is James McKee, Managing Director at Climate Investment, a venture capital and growth equity investment firm located in the US. Today, we're going to tackle why a narrow investment thesis increases your deal flow, and secondly, how two-thirds of the big carbon emission sector is underinvested in to tackle climate change. So let's jump in. Welcome to the podcast, James. James, if you could give us a 60 to 90 second breakdown of you, please.
Okay, certainly. So first of all, Alex, thank you very much for hosting me on the podcast. I'm delighted to be with you today. So I am a managing director with a investment firm called Climate Investment. We were founded by the OGCI, which is a collection of oil and gas companies that are committed to decarbonization in the energy and heavy industrial sectors. Lot of name brands that you would recognize, including BP, Shell, Saudi Aramco, Chevron. And I've been with the firm for about 4 years now. You know, my focus within the investment team has been on physical asset solutions and structured finance. And what we do at Climate Investment is focus our capital deployments on solutions for reducing greenhouse gases from what we refer to as the hard to abate sectors. That obviously includes oil and gas, but also things like cement, steel, industrial gases, transportation, particularly kind of heavy transportation that would also include like ocean going freight. And you know, we tend to focus on areas that are historically having difficulty attracting capital for decarbonization. We have two funds that we are investing out of right now. So we're around $1.5 billion under management. Those two funds include one we call the Catalyst Fund, which is an early stage, you know, venture and development stage capital fund. And we also have a growth equity fund we refer to as the Decarbonization Acceleration Fund. We have 37 companies in our portfolio today. We've been deploying capital since 2017, and we very specifically measure the carbon impact of our portfolio and report it publicly. So, you know, we're targeting investments that can reduce more than 1 million tons per year of CO2 equivalents within a certain period of time. And, you know, we're looking for things that can really be scaled. More specifically about me, prior to joining Climate Investment in the beginning of 2020, my career was primarily in investments, M&A, and structured finance in the power and renewables business.
Makes sense. Obviously, easy enough connect through to what you're doing at the moment. So it sounds like a lot of your LPs, should you wish, are actually coming from the oil and gas companies in order to fund these strategies for then companies to then sell products to them to then reduce their carbon output. Is that pretty much accurate?
That is fairly accurate. Yes. So, the idea is that they recognize that to address their scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions, they needed to have a wider lens. And the oil and gas climate initiative is not really a legal entity. It's just kind of a CEO-led consortium of these companies that originally started out as essentially a strategy and policy group of how they could collaborate on things within their core businesses to, you know, reduce the carbon footprint of oil and gas. But then they said, well, you know, let's take it a step further. And then they said, let's fund an investment team that can go out and look for these solutions. And let's not limit them just to things for oil and gas, but let's have an engagement model so that things that the investment team finds can be of use to them. So, for instance, only about a third of our portfolio have solutions that are directly related to oil and gas. However, we do have a lot of engagement with those oil and gas limited partners where they have what we call deployment champions available that are responsible for reviewing the solutions within the portfolio. And the benefit of that is that, you know, over the last 4 years, 4 or 5 years, actually, we have had around 120 pilots and deployments that have been conducted by our LPs with our portfolio companies. And a lot of those have turned into significant commercial orders that not only does it bring solutions that help the LPs with their own decarbonization goals, but obviously being able to get the buy-in and some of the orders from large customers like this help our portfolio companies move along their commercialization pathway.
Excellent. And what's one mistake that you see private equity firms or portfolio companies making, and what actions would you suggest to correct them?
Yeah, you know, I would say one of the biggest ones I see, and, you know, everyone makes this same mistake, is kind of underestimating the execution challenges, as well as the time it takes for these, you know, growing businesses to reach the key milestones that they need, you know, in their commercialization and their scaling. Everyone has seen a pitch deck with the hockey stick curve, and that's fine. We're used to that. But you really need to dig in to, well, what are the assumptions behind that? And, you know, what are the tools and personnel and experience and just reality that you need? So, for instance, a lot of the investments that I have worked with involve, you know, building physical assets, that things that might eventually be what you call an infrastructure asset. And there's a regulatory framework that often has to work, you know, with that, including, you know, a permitting regime. If a company is expecting that they're going to reach a certain commercial milestone on a physical asset in 18 months, but they haven't filed a permit application yet for something that historically takes 2 years, well, that should be a red flag right there. But I've seen, you know, entrepreneurs and investors, and I'll say we're sometimes guilty of this, of being so optimistic. It's like, oh, well, it's going to be different this time. It might be different, but I don't know that you should necessarily make your underwriting case so optimistic that you and your returns are relying on a first in terms of something advancing in a timeline that hasn't been done before.
How do you try and keep realistic when clearly you get excited about a product or service, something that can make significant impact? There's something here that can take your millions of carbon atoms or carbon dioxide atoms out of the atmosphere. I can understand why investors get carried away, need to deploy capital, etc. How do you kind of keep that realistic head on your shoulders when reviewing investments?
Well, I think you need to start by being data-driven. And, you know, when, you know, whether it's the entrepreneur or it's the deal team or the analyst say, well, you know, it's different this time and this is how it's going to work. Say, all right, well, show me the data that can help us understand, well, why it should be different, because certainly things advance. And, you know, we've all seen companies that have been around for 15 years and, you know, a lot of times say, oh, well, we've seen that company 4 times in the last 10 years. They may actually, in some cases, get to a point where there is a breakthrough and maybe something is different. But you need to ask that question. You know, what's different this time? Pattern recognition is, you know, a pretty important thing as an investor, from both, you know, technology that advances as well as kind of business models and commercial elements. I think that there's always room for disruption, but you need to have a well thought out case about, you know, why that disruption is actually going to take hold in this particular circumstance. You shouldn't rely on it just simply being, well, the CEO is charismatic and that's going to make the difference.
Makes sense.
Sorry to interrupt. Just a quick mention of our longstanding partnership with Grata. As you will probably know, the private equity scene is constantly evolving, and deal flow is moving now to proprietary and data-driven processes. Grata provides you with the data and information of over 7 million private companies. So if you're looking to improve your proprietary deal flow and improve the data access, then reach out to Grata today. Now back to the podcast.
So you mentioned, was it 37 portfolio companies within your platform?
Yes.
From reviewing, you know, the portfolio companies' products and services, both attributed to from your investments, but also across the firm, the general consensus is to reduce environmental impact of high detriment environmental impact companies, such as oil and gas businesses, as we mentioned earlier, yes, which is driven through, you know, some of your LP base. Are these typical types of investments and these companies difficult to find that also have a strong proposition for actual growth?
So I would say it's not difficult to find opportunities that opportunities that claim to produce that benefit, mm-hmm. but it is difficult to find the ones that we believe can execute at the level of carbon impact scale that we are talking about. So I'll get a little specific about this. So we believe in a concept I refer to as the time value of mm-hmm. carbon abatement. Everyone's seen, you know, kind of the UN curves and the COP curves about, you know, what we need to do on our pathway to a 1.5 or 2, you know, degree C, future. And, you know, for every year that you fail to reach a decarbonization goal, it just shifts that curve up higher. So it's not good enough to say, well, we're going to reduce a gigaton in 2045 or 2050, because if you don't reduce several hundred million tons in the late 2020s and 2030, well, you're going to need to reduce, you know, several gigatons by 2045, because there's this cumulative effect. So because of that, our mandate and our first screening criteria for investments is, how much CO2 equivalent can this investment reduce within a specific period of time? So in our first fund, you know, that metric is by 2030. With our growth equity fund, we're looking at 2033, 2034. So, and we're looking for businesses that we believe can scale up to more than 1 million tons per year of abatement by that time period. A lot of the deal flow that we see, it doesn't pass that first test. Certainly, a lot of the ones that are things that are, say, at like a consumer level, we have difficulty finding things where it can scale up, to the point of, you know, reaching that level. So I'll give you an example. There is this, I won't name the company, but there's this really, really neat, company that we were evaluating not too long ago. And it's in a plastics recycling business, where kind of replacing single-use plastics with, similar things that can be used over and over again. And they even provide, kind of stations for cleaning and reuse and that sort of thing. And it's something that can be used in, you know, kind of consumer applications as well as, you know, venues and entertainment. Love the company. They're doing great. They're growing really well. But the level of carbon impact that they're doing, it's just not going to make it there. So they might be the number one business in this solution, which is great. And I love recycling. But for us, for them to get to 1 million tons a year by, you know, 2030, they would have to scale by a factor of like 3,000, you know, from where they are today. And maybe they can do it, but, you know, it just wouldn't be the best use of our capital to take that bet. So then that brings us back to the sectors that we do focus on that are more industrial in nature. So if your goal is to reduce the greatest amount of CO2 equivalents, then go to where the emissions are the highest and the most concentrated. So that's why we're going to these industrial, these industrial processes where you've got point source emissions that, you know, are capable of being reduced, you know, in a few number of, you know, like a smaller number of locations, maybe in like the hundreds, you know, as opposed to hundreds of thousands.
So if we, with your investment strategy of driving and understanding these businesses, you've got quite a tight understanding of the type of company that you want, which I highly applaud and recommend. A lot of private equity firms will invest in whatever they can.
Yeah.
Do you have that model because, and I'm going to guess that you have a particularly good deal flow and therefore you can be more particular on the types of businesses, or is there another reason that's allowed you to give such a stringent, we will only invest in this type of organization. They have to be doing this. They have to have 1 million tons outside of the taken, removed from the atmosphere or not allowed to go into the atmosphere by 2030. What's allowing you to have that stringent nature? Because I'm sure that's a little bit restrictive, but also makes it very clear on your investment mandate and thesis.
Yeah. You know, it can be restrictive, but you know, in the first part of your question, you're right. We do have sufficient deal flow that I wouldn't call it a limiting factor. So, our deal flow now, we probably see somewhere between 900 and, 900 and 1100, you know, opportunities that come through every year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the most number of investments we've ever made in a single year was probably, you know, 9 or 10. So we're at a roughly 1% yield. Now, obviously, you know, a high number of that 1,000 that come in, you know, we'll look at it very quickly and just say, well, it's very much out of scope, right? And it's not doing, it doesn't have an impact focus at all. But then we do have a pretty well-defined methodology that we can down select from that remaining set to, maybe a couple hundred, or even, you know, less than 100 deals that we'll sort of take through a very early stage of diligence and analysis, or even just take the call, you know, and listen to the pitch. So I think that it does help us in being very focused. But, you know, it does act, you know, that focus does have us sometimes passing on deals that could be very compelling, but for it just doesn't really match our particular mandate.
I think it's great that you guys have got such a tight mandate, tight criteria, clear on what you're looking for, and no doubt that actually increases your deal flow, whereas most people think that would threaten it from there. So yeah. Talking about deal flow to capital flow, what's your take on the kind of current flow of capital to or headed as climate improvement and its actual allocation to solve what's regarded as the climate crisis?
Yeah, no, Alex, thanks for asking that question. It's a really good one. I'll start with the positives. You know, first, it's wonderful that so much capital is flowing towards energy transition and you know, climate action. There's a lot of capital needed. I think I saw a report recently that somewhere in the neighborhood of, 1.8 trillion, US dollars, were, raised and deployed, in the last year. We need to roughly triple or quadruple that number, but it's a good start. So one of the things we've observed is that there's a lot of concentration of the capital. A lot of energy transition funds are out there. Energy transition for most of these funds means conventional renewables, wind, solar, now battery storage, which is a very, very important part of the solution. Look, I came from renewables. I'm a big fan. So I think, replacing fossil fuels with clean generation is an important part of the solution. And it's one of the reasons, why I'm in my current role. I made the switch over because I kind of had this realization one day that if we replace every fossil-fueled power plant on Earth with wind, solar, and batteries, that only addresses about 30% of the total emissions goals that we need, or reduction goals that we need to reach, that 1.5 degree Celsius case. So, not as much capital has been flowing to what we call these hard to abate sectors, in part because it's hard, right? It's hard. Not a lot of these things have been done before. I've spent a lot of time focused on carbon capture and sequestration. Actually, the technology is there. It's not new technology. Companies have been injecting CO2 into the ground for decades, and doing it safely. But in terms of, capturing it from the point sources and then piping it to a place where you're going to secure it, or even better, finding, processes for turning that CO2 into a useful product, there hasn't been as much capital deployed to those solutions. And if we're really going to scale climate action, you need to direct capital towards the things that are new and emerging. So statistically, we kind of studied this last year. Of all the private capital, between, anywhere from venture to infrastructure that has been labeled as climate focused, roughly 80% of it has been going to a small number of sectors, such as, renewables and passenger vehicle transportation, electric vehicles and charging stations, which is all great, but those sectors only account for about 30-35% of the total emissions. So you have this big mismatch of 80% of the capital going to only a third of the problem. And, we really need to get catalytic capital into that remaining two-thirds so that we can demonstrate that these business models can be successful. And once that's been demonstrated, then private capital is going to say, oh, okay, I can actually make money at this. And then more capital is going to flow in. And that's sort of how our mission got defined.
Not only am I the host of the Private Equity Podcast, but I'm also the founder and managing partner of Raw Selection. Raw Selection is a private equity specialist executive search firm with two divisions, one that focuses on portfolio C-suite executive hires, and one that focuses on private equity direct hires of your back office and investment deal professionals, operating across Europe and North America. A unique offering of our service is that we offer a full money-back guarantee on all upfront deposits. We typically take around $10,000 as an upfront deposit to commence a search process. The remainder is then on completion, but that upfront deposit is completely refundable. If you're not happy with our service, we will refund that upfront deposit, no questions asked.
Where do you think that challenge comes from? Do you think it sits at the PE VC level, not offering something like a vessel that will solve that remaining two-third challenge? Do we think that there isn't as much of a call from an LP perspective because, it's perceived as sexy to invest in electronic vehicles and Tesla ripping up the world maps? Where do you see the actual catalyst of the problem actually coming from?
So I think one of the problems is just the expected horizons for the investments fund. So, typical, PE fund, they're going to have a, 4 or 5 year investment period. It's going to be a 10-year, closed end fund. It's difficult to invest in emerging sectors and, be able to, make a return on your capital for your LPs in that tighter timeline. So I think you need to provide incentives for the GPs and their investors, to take risk and to, invest in things that are going to take a little bit longer, to produce that climate impact. Part of it comes down to the compensation models. We're seeing more and more, and I applaud this, that compensation for the investment teams has an element tied to the environmental impact, not just the financial returns of the portfolio. So I think that helps to, attract professionals that want to be mission-driven, but for, career reasons, maybe have been taking, opportunities that did not prioritize that as much.
Makes sense. So, James, what do you read? What do you watch? What do you listen to that you should recommend that others check out, please?
So I'm kind of boring in what I read. So I get a lot of news, and I try and get it from a lot of different sources. So like a lot of people, I often wonder, how much of the unbiased story am I getting from any one particular source? So I do my best to read things from the left, the right, and the center. So I'm, every time I see an article in, on CNN, I will also go look for how that same headline's being covered in the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, and Fox News. Although Fox News has sort of like a paywall up now, so I don't get as many of their articles anymore. And then there's some podcasts that I enjoy listening to. One that I really enjoy. That I do on kind of my morning exercise routine. I like the How I Built This, podcast that Guy Raz does. It's one that I started listening to, when I got more into private equity, because I really am fascinated by the stories of I'm fascinated by the stories of these entrepreneurs and their pathways to success. There's definitely no cookie cutter, and every time I listen to one, particularly the challenges that they have, had to overcome, I'm always finding some little nugget that I can apply to something that's going on somewhere in our portfolio.
Perfect. Appreciate those recommendations. How does anybody reach out to you, James, if they wish to do so, post the podcast, please?
Oh, certainly. So, I'm on LinkedIn, so certainly you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm also reachable at Climate Investments through our website. Climateinvestment.com. You can find a link there for submitting investment proposals. I'd say you can also reach out to me directly on my business email, which is jamesm@climateinvestment.com.
Perfect. We'll add that all to the show notes. Well, thank you very much, James, for coming on the podcast, giving us a real insight into the pretty narrow investment thesis and why that's benefited your organization and driven you to be able to make bigger impacts in what you're doing and selective on those particular deals, but also a huge insight into climate investing as a whole. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Alex. I was delighted to chat with you today.
And as always, for all our listeners, thank you very much for joining us. And of course, should you ever need support in securing private equity professionals or portfolio executives across Europe or North America, please do reach out to us at Royal Selection. But till the next time, keep smashing it, and thank you very much for listening.